This is Audible.
The Coming of Conan the Cimmerian by Robert E. Howard. Narrated by Todd McLaren. Copyright 2002 by Conan Properties International, LLC. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with the Random House Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2009 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Introduction. When the December 1932 issue of Weird Tales appeared on newsstands, Robert E. Howard, born 1906, died 1936, probably didn't imagine that he was making history. The Phoenix on the Sword, introducing his new character, Conan of Cimmeria, had been written in March of that year. And even if editor Farnsworth Wright thought the story had points of real excellence, it was not enough to warrant making it the cover story. The first Conan story was simply one tale among others in that particular issue of Weird Tales. 70 years later, the character has achieved international fame. Virtually every country in the world has published the Conan tales. One success leading to another, the character has been featured in motion pictures, comic books, cartoons, pastiches, television series, toys, and role-playing games. In the process, Howard's creation has been diluted to the point that it is often nearly impossible to recognize Howard's character in the iconic image of the fur-clad, hyper-muscled superhero he has become in the public's mind. Such a phenomenon is not rare in the history of popular culture. When a fictional character becomes such an icon, it is bound to escape its creator and take on a life of its own, the character taking precedence over the creator. Dracula, Fu Manchu, and Tarzan are instantly recognizable figures, while creators Bram Stoker, Sax Rohmer, and Edgar Rice Burroughs enjoy a popularity both inferior to and dependent upon these particular creations. As an example, many Burroughs readers had their first exposure to Tarzan by way of the movies or comic strips, and were subsequently led to buy the original books. They could then judge for themselves whether the adaptations were faithful to the original. In Howard's case, however, this has been impossible. Until the present publication, Howard's Conan stories had never been published as Howard wrote them, in the order in which he wrote them, in a uniform collection. While there is nothing inherently wrong with the idea of establishing a character's biography, no Sherlock Holmes scholar ever entertained the idea of repackaging Conan Doyle's original stories in the order of their occurrence in Holmes' life rather than the order in which they were written, or inserting pastiches amidst the established canon. This was, however, exactly what was done with the Conan stories. Not only were they presented following someone else's reconstruction of the character's biography, but pastiches of arguable quality, to say the least, were interpolated among Howard's tales. Further, some of Howard's own stories were rewritten. Other non-Conan Howard tales were artificially transformed into Conan ones, and Conan stories that Howard thought too little of to finish were completed by other writers. This whole concept of posthumous collaboration, as it was termed, made it very difficult for the casual reader to determine what was genuine Howard and what was poor aping or rewriting in those volumes. In other words, people lured to Howard's Conan stories after encountering adaptations or pastiches simply found more of the same, not having detailed information to separate the wheat from the tares. This has made critical assessment of the Conan stories a difficult thing. The Texan has often been judged on writings that were either not his or had been tampered with. Howard himself suggested why the story should not be presented in the order they occurred in the character's life. "In writing these yarns, I've always felt less as creating them than as if I were simply chronicling his adventures as he told them to me. That's why they skip about so much, without following a regular order. The average adventurer, telling tales of a wild life at random, seldom follows any ordered plan, but narrates episodes widely separated by space and years as they occur to him." Consequently, the stories in this volume are published as they occurred to Howard, in the order they were written, and as they were written by Howard. No pastiches, no changes for the sake of consistency, no rewriting. Such a presentation not only respects Howard's intentions, it also casts a very different light on the character and his evolution, and provides us with new insights to some of the major themes of the series. At the time the December 1932 issue of Weird Tales went on sale, Howard was becoming one of the magazine's pillars. The magazine had published the Texan's first professional story, Spear and Fang, in July 1925, and over the years, his tales had been appearing with increasing frequency between its covers. He had won his first cover with Wolf's Head in the April 1926 issue, and had introduced the fan-favorite character Solomon Kane with Red Shadows in August 1928, again featured on the cover. A year later, Howard had won the admiration and respect of his peers, most notably Howard Phillips Lovecraft, with his two stories about Cull of Atlantis, The Shadow Kingdom, and The Mirrors of Tuzun-Thun, published in the August and September 1929 issues. It can be said that Robert E. Howard had been a protege of Weird Tales editor Farnsworth Wright. Wright nurtured the young Texan's burgeoning talent, and would later describe him as one of his literary discoveries, as well as a genius and a friend. Wright was indeed an unusual editor. In a world of formula and cliché-ridden pulp magazines, Weird Tales often lived up to its subtitle, The Unique Magazine, walking a fine line between the magazine's commercial imperatives and Wright's literary inclinations. While Lovecraft would often have his tales rejected, unable or unwilling to submit to Wright's editorial requirements or suggestions, Howard was more flexible. Studying and anticipating his editor's needs, he had no problem turning out dozens of formula stories, with the occasional gem here and there, for such generic magazines as Fight Stories or Action Stories. On the other hand, the Texan had genuine literary leanings, most evident in his poetry, but for which there was no viable market. Weird Tales came at the right time for the young writer. This atypical magazine published a large number of Howard's poems, as well as the cream of his fiction. The tales of Solomon Kane, Cull, Bran MacMorn, and Conan the Cimmerian. Not coincidentally, of all his rather numerous characters, Howard wrote poems about only those four, if we accept Cimmeria as a poem about Conan's homeland. The Texan was evidently more involved when writing Conan tales than he was when writing for more generic markets. It is significant to note that the first Conan story was a rewrite of a Cull story, By This Axe I Rule, completed in 1929. Like the Conan tales, the Cull stories were centered around the exploits of a barbarian adventurer in exotic countries of Earth's mythical past, but there ends the similarity. Between 1929 and 1932, Howard had developed new ambitions for his fantasy stories. He had, first of all, succeeded in selling some historical fiction, which gave him the occasion to write on the epic scale. Howard infused those stories with an intensity that has been rarely equaled, delivering memorable tales of the later Crusades. He excelled at depicting the slow decay of the once powerful empire of Altrimer, crumbling under internal divisions and external attacks, a prevalent theme of the future Conan stories. Selling historical fiction on a regular basis, however, proved to be an arduous task. Of his interest in the genre and difficulties in the market, Howard wrote in 1933, "There is no literary work to me half as zestful as rewriting history in the guise of fiction. I wish I was able to devote the rest of my life to that kind of work. I could never make a living writing such things, though. The markets are too scanty, with requirements too narrow, and it takes me so long to complete one. I try to write as true to the actual facts as possible. At least, I try to commit as few errors as possible. I like to have my background and setting as accurate and realistic as I can with my limited knowledge. If I twist facts too much, alter dates, as some writers do, or present a character out of keeping with my impressions of the time and place, I lose my sense of reality, and my characters cease to be living and vital things. And my stories center entirely on my conceptions of my characters. Once I lose the feel of my characters, I might as well tear up what I have written. All these elements were probably at the back of Howard's mind in February 1932, when he transformed By This Axe I Rule into The Phoenix on the Sword. By dropping the love interest of the former story and adding a weird touch to his revision, Howard knew what he was doing. Unlike his previous series, the first Conan tale was tailored specifically to meet Weird Tales' requirements. However, taking control of the marketing aspects of the story was one thing. Keeping in check the creative forces that brought the barbarian character to life was another entirely. The man Conan seemed suddenly to grow up in my mind without much labor on my part, and immediately a stream of stories flowed off my pen, or rather off my typewriter, almost without effort on my part. I did not seem to be creating, but rather relating events that had occurred. Episode crowded on episode so fast that I could scarcely keep up with them. For weeks I did nothing but write of the adventures of Conan. The character took complete possession of my mind and crowded out everything else in the way of story writing. With a first story featuring Conan as the middle-aged king of Aquilonia, a second as a young barbarian in the northern fringes of the world, and a third as a young barbarian thief in the civilized city of Numalia. Different periods of the character's life, and widely scattered geographic locations in each case, Howard was running the risk of losing himself in this character and his universe. This had happened with the Cull stories, in which the loss of Howard's sense of reality is discernible. He thus decided to have his background and setting accurate and realistic. The creation of a self-coherent universe was the perfect solution to Howard's needs and aspirations. His decision to people his Hyborian age with Cimmerians, Vanirs, Numidians, and Afghulis, thinly disguised names borrowed from history or legendary, was never really understood. Years later, Lovecraft would take Howard to task for this. "The only flaw in this stuff is R.E.H.'s incurable tendency to devise names too closely resembling actual names, names which, for us, have a very different set of associations." Lovecraft, and a host of others after him, couldn't see that Howard never intended to create a universe removed from our own, as he had done when writing the Cull stories, and as so many writers of epic fantasy have done since. By carefully choosing names that resembled those found in our history and legendary, Howard wanted to ensure that no reader would be left wondering what a Turanian looked like, or be aware that his Vanir and Aesir lived in the northern parts of the world. By telescoping history and geography to create a universe that was new and yet familiar, Howard was deliberately striving for efficacy and stereotype, a technique that allowed him to create an exotic background with a minimum of description. He was, at the same time, answering his own need to have an accurate and realistic background for the series, while creating a method for writing pseudo-historical tales without the risk of anachronism or factual errors. The first three Conan stories, completed before the Hyborian Age was written, may be seen as experimental efforts, before Howard had a firm grasp of his character's environment and of the new series' potential. It was with his fourth and fifth offerings, The Tower of the Elephant and The Scarlet Citadel, that Howard added this epic and pseudo-historical dimension to his new series. From this point onward, the Conan stories became something more than the adventures of a barbarian adventurer in an imaginary kingdom, as had been the case with the Cull stories. From story to story, Conan could be a king in medieval Europe, the Scarlet Citadel, a general in an antique Assyria torn with rivalries between city-states, Black Colossus, or a member of the Wild Cossacks. The term is transparent enough, of the East. As Howard once wrote, "My study of history has been a continual search for newer barbarians from age to age." With the creation of the Hyborian Age, he had offered himself a universe where all those barbarian peoples could coexist in the same time frame, and, in Conan the Cimmerian, the perfect vehicle to express his views on barbarism and civilization. In many of these stories, the Cimmerian finds himself in one of the borderlands of the Hyborian Age, where barbarism and civilization clash on an epic scale, with armies numbering in the tens of thousands. These large-scale battles find an echo in incidents of a more private order, often providing the stories with memorable scenes and lines of dialogue, such as Conan's recounting his trial in Queen of the Black Coast. "I choked my ire and held my peace, and the judge squalled that I had shown contempt for the court, and that I should be hurled into a dungeon to rot until I betrayed my friend. So then, seeing they were all mad, I drew my sword and cleft the judge's skull." Or Howard's acerbic aside in The Tower of the Elephant. "Civilized men are more discourteous than savages, because they know they can be impolite without having their skulls split as a general thing." Manifestly, the majority of Howard's work, and the Conan tales in particular, can be read as an exploration of the theme of barbarism versus civilization, with Howard standing firmly on the barbarian side. This deep-rooted interest fueled Howard's writings from the beginning, and became the major theme of discussion in the Texan's correspondence with Lovecraft, initiated in 1930. Confronted by the erudite writer from Providence, Howard found himself forced to back his opinions with historical and political data. Consequently, the Conan tales quite often echo ideas expressed in the correspondence, and vice versa. More aware than anyone else of Howard's positions and convictions, Lovecraft was in a privileged position to fully appreciate the Conan tales and their subtext. Shortly after Howard's death, Lovecraft thus wrote, "It is hard to describe precisely what made Mr. Howard's stories stand out so sharply. But the real secret is that he himself is in every one of them." The perceptive author here touched upon a major key to the Conan series, explaining at the same time the internal force and sincerity of the tales, and the reason no Conan pastiche could ever hope to attain the level of the original stories. If Howard's Conan tales make for particularly well-crafted escapist fiction, providing the reader with colorful high-adventure stories, the best of them deliver much more. A grim undercurrent pervades the whole series, often leaving the reader with mixed emotions, the sensation of having experienced something at once exhilarating and depressing. Howard's best Conan stories, we may cite The Tower of the Elephant, Queen of the Black Coast, Beyond the Black River, and Red Nails, are also those that have a sad ending. Dark undercurrents flow beneath the veneer of this escapist fiction. Conan's philosophy is best expressed in one passage from Queen of the Black Coast. "In this world, men struggle and suffer vainly, finding pleasure only in the bright madness of battle. Let me live deep while I live. Let me know the rich juices of red meat and stinging vine on my palate, the hot embrace of white arms, the mad exultation of battle when the blue blades flame in crimson, and I am content. Let teachers and priests and philosophers brood over questions of reality and illusion. I know this. If life is illusion, then I am no less an illusion, and being thus, the illusion is real to me. I live, I burn with life, I love, I slay, and am content." This is indeed one of the major characteristics of the Cimmerian. He lives for the moment, savoring each instant, not caring about the past nor about the future. Yesterday a Cossack, today a king, tomorrow a thief. It is in that sense that the Conan stories are escapist literature. Their appeal seems universal, transcending generations and cultures. As Howard once confided, A man reading a story about Conan, then, would feel again in the depth of his being those barbaric impulses. Consequently, Conan acted as they felt they would act in similar circumstances. What sets the Conan stories apart, however, is the distinct sensation that the thrill of adventure in these stories is but a mask. That it is, in fact, never really possible to forget the grim realities of the world. Conan's Hyborian Age began with a cataclysm, and ended with another cataclysm. Whatever the Hyborians and Conan can accomplish has no meaning at all in the final analysis, and is eventually bound to destruction and oblivion. Human life and empires are equally transient in Howard. Civilization is not the final phase of human development. It may be an inevitable consequence of that development, but it is a transitory state. Civilizations are bound to wither and decay, eventually to be swept over by conquering hordes of savages or barbarians who will themselves, after a time, become civilized. In this cycle, it was with the state of barbarism that Howard recognized his kinship. This was not a case, as some commentators have argued, of belief in the superiority of barbarism over civilization, or of a conception of the barbarian as a noble savage. I have no idyllic view of barbarism. As near as I can learn, it's a grim, bloody, ferocious, and loveless condition. I have no patience with a depiction of the barbarian of any race as a stately, godlike child of nature, endowed with strange wisdom and speaking in measured and sonorous phrases. Probably the best metaphor of barbaric life as envisioned by Howard is found in Beyond the Black River, where the protagonists are caught between hammer and anvil. Beyond their settlement on the Black River dwell the savage Picts, ready to attack them at any moment. Behind it and Thunder River are the forces of civilization, too decadent and divided among themselves to ensure their own survival, much less that of their frontiers. The tale carries this grim predicament to its logical conclusion, and Conan, the only one of the characters born into barbarism rather than civilization, is the sole survivor. The civilizing process had severed Conan's allies from their instincts, and not having this elemental aspect inborn in the Cimmerian, they could not hope to prevail. The tale's concluding lines, without a doubt Howard's most quoted statement, attest to that. Barbarism is the natural state of mankind. Civilization is unnatural. It is a whim of circumstance. And barbarism must always, ultimately, triumph. The civilizing process bears in itself the seeds of its own destruction by removing itself from what is natural. What is unnatural cannot endure. It will either succumb to natural forces, as described in Beyond the Black River, or it will slowly decay and destroy itself in a horrible fashion, as exemplified in Zuthal of the Dusk and Red Nails. The reasons behind Howard's fascination with the theme of decaying civilizations, which may very well be at the root of his interest in barbaric life, were probably very complex. Much more than in the evolutionist theories of the time, which the stories sometimes echo, it is probably in Howard's biography and psychology that the answer resides. There is indeed something intensely personal in these convictions, which transcends the stories and contributes to much of their strength. There is no denying that not all the Conan stories are on the same level as those we have mentioned. In a time of financial difficulties, it soon became easy enough for Howard to make of Conan his meal ticket. Most of the more routine Conan stories, systematically featuring semi-naked ladies, which had been entirely absent from the series until then, were indeed composed between November 1932 and March 1933, at a time when Howard was in dire need of money. Incidentally, the fact that most Conan pastiches found their inspiration from such stories, and not Red Nails or Queen of the Black Coast, is a testimony to the critical eye of their authors. Most of these stories have something genuinely Howardian in them. As Lovecraft once wrote, Howard was greater than any money-making policy he could adopt. but they are clearly exploiting a formula calculated to win the cover illustration. With the tales of Conan of Cimmeria, Howard was out for more than pulpish fare. While he could have turned out story after story of the adventures of a Cimmerian killing monsters and lusting after scantily clad damsels in distress, assuring himself a regular income, Howard decided not to turn his Cimmerian into an industry. The mark of the true author, he didn't hesitate to experiment with new types of stories, to take risks at a time when their sale and commercial success would have been assured otherwise. If the true work of art is something that at once attracts and disturbs, then the Conan stories are something special, an epic painted in bright colors, featuring heroic deeds and larger-than-life characters in fabled lands, but with something darker lying beneath. Scratch the veneer at your own risk. Patrice Lumet, 2002. Cimmeria. Written in Mission, Texas, February 1932, suggested by the memory of the hill country above Fredericksburg, seen in a mist of winter rain. Robert E. Howard. I remember the dark woods masking slopes of somber hills, the gray clouds' leaden everlasting arch, the dusky streams that flowed without a sound, and the lone winds that whispered down the passes. Vista on vista marching, hills on hills, slope beyond slope, each dark with sullen trees, our gaunt land lay. So when a man climbed up a rugged peak and gazed, his shaded eye saw but the endless vista, hill on hill, slope beyond slope, each hooded like its brothers. It was a gloomy land that seemed to hold all winds and clouds and dreams that shun the sun, with bare boughs rattling in the lonesome winds, and the dark woodlands brooding over all. Not even lightened by the rare dim sun, which made squat shadows out of men, they called it Cimmeria, land of darkness and deep night. It was so long ago and far away. I have forgot the very name men called me. The axe and flint-tipped spear are like a dream, and hunts and wars are shadows. I recall only the stillness of that somber land, the clouds that piled forever on the hills, the dimness of the everlasting woods. Cimmeria, land of darkness and the night. O soul of mine, born out of shadowed hills, to clouds and winds and ghosts that shun the sun, how many deaths shall serve to break at last this heritage which wraps me in the gray apparel of ghosts? I search my heart and find Cimmeria, land of darkness and the night. The Phoenix on the Sword. Know, O Prince, that between the years when the oceans drank Atlantis and the gleaming cities, and the years of the rise of the sons of Arias, there was an age undreamed of when shining kingdoms lay spread across the world like blue mantles beneath the stars. Nemedia, Ophir, Berthunia, Hyperborea, Zamora with its dark-haired women and towers of spider-haunted mystery, Zingara with its chivalry, Koth that bordered on the pastoral lands of Shem, Stygia with its shadow-guarded tombs, Hyrcania whose riders wore steel and silk and gold. But the proudest kingdom of the world was Aquilonia, reigning supreme in the dreaming west. Hither came Conan the Cimmerian, black-haired, sullen-eyed, sword in hand, a thief, a reaver, a slayer, with gigantic melancholies and gigantic mirth, to tread the jeweled thrones of the earth under his sandaled fret. The Nemedian Chronicles. Over shadowy spires and gleaming towers lay the ghostly darkness and silence that runs before dawn. into a dim alley, one of a veritable labyrinth of mysterious, winding ways, four masked figures came hurriedly from a door which a dusky hand furtively opened. They spoke not, but went swiftly into the gloom, cloaks wrapped closely about them. As silently as the ghosts of murdered men, they disappeared in the darkness. Behind them, a sardonic countenance was framed in the partly open door. A pair of evil eyes glittered malevolently in the gloom.
"Go into the night, creatures of the night," a voice mocked. "Oh, fools, your doom hounds your heels like a blind dog, and you know it not."
The speaker closed the door and bolted it, then turned and went up the corridor, candle in hand. He was a somber giant, whose dusky skin revealed his Stygian blood. He came into an inner chamber, where a tall, lean man in worn velvet lounged like a great lazy cat on a silken couch, sipping wine from a huge golden goblet.
"Well, Ascalante," said the Stygian, setting down the candle, "your dupes have slunk into the streets like rats from their burrows. You work with strange tools."
"Tools?" replied Ascalante. "Why, they consider me that. For months now, ever since the rebel force summoned me from the southern desert, I have been living in the very heart of my enemies, hiding by day in this obscure house, skulking through dark alleys and darker corridors at night. And I have accomplished what those rebellious nobles could not. Working through them and through other agents, many of whom have never seen my face, I have honeycombed the empire with sedition and unrest. In short, I, working in the shadows, have paved the downfall of the king who sits throned in the sun. By Mitra, I was a statesman before I was an outlaw."
"And these dupes who deem themselves your masters?"
"They will continue to think that I serve them until our present task is completed. Who are they to match wits with Ascalante? Volmana, the dwarfish Count of Caraban. Grommel, the giant commander of the Black Legion. Dion, the fat Baron of Attalus. Rinaldo, the hare-brained minstrel. I am the force which has welded together the steel in each, and by the clay in each I will crush them when the time comes. But that lies in the future. Tonight, the king dies."
"Days ago I saw the imperial squadrons ride from the city," said the Stygian.
"They rode to the frontier, which the heathen Picts assail, thanks to the strong liquor which I've smuggled over the borders to madden them. Dion's great wealth made that possible. And Volmana made it possible to dispose of the rest of the imperial troops which remained in the city. Through his princely kin in Emedia, it was easy to persuade King Numa to request the presence of Count Trocero of Poitain, Seneschal of Aquilonia. And, of course, to do him honor, he'll be accompanied by an imperial escort, as well as his own troops. And Prospero, King Conan's right-hand man. That leaves only the king's personal bodyguard in the city, besides the Black Legion. Through Grommel, I've corrupted a spendthrift officer of that guard, and bribed him to lead his men away from the king's door at midnight. Then, with 16 desperate rogues of mine, we enter the palace by a secret tunnel. After the deed is done, even if the people do not rise to welcome us, Grommel's Black Legion will be sufficient to hold the city and the crown."
"And Dion thinks that crown will be given to him?"
"Yes. The fat fool claims it by reason of a trace and royal blood. Conan makes a bad mistake in letting men live who still boast descent from the old dynasty, from which he tore the crown of Aquilonia. Volmana wishes to be reinstated in royal favor, as he was under the old regime, so that he may lift his poverty-ridden estates to their former grandeur. Grommel hates Palantides, commander of the Black Dragons, and desires the command of the whole army with all the stubbornness of the Bossonian. Alone of us all, Rinaldo has no personal ambition. He sees in Conan a red-handed, rough-footed barbarian who came out of the north to plunder a civilized land. He idealizes the king whom Conan killed to get the crown, remembering only that he occasionally patronized the arts, and forgetting the evils of his reign. And he is making the people forget. Already they openly sing The Lament for the King, in which Rinaldo lauds the sainted villain and denounces Conan as that black-hearted savage from the abyss. Conan laughs, but the people snarl.
Why does he hate Conan?
Poets always hate those in power. To them, perfection is always just behind the last corner, or beyond the next. They escape the present in dreams of the past and future. Rinaldo is a flaming torch of idealism, rising, as he thinks, to overthrow a tyrant and liberate the people. As for me, well, a few months ago I had lost all ambition but to raid the caravans for the rest of my life. Now, old dreams stir. Conan will die. Dion will mount the throne. Then he too will die. One by one, all who oppose me will die, by fire or steel or those deadly wines you know so well how to brew. Ascalante, King of Aquilonia! How do you like the sound of it?
The Stygian shrugged his broad shoulders. There was a time, he said with unconcealed bitterness, when I too had my ambitions, beside which yours seem tawdry and childish. To what a state I have fallen! My old-time peers and rivals would stare indeed could they see Thothamon of the Ring serving as the slave of an outlander, and an outlaw at that, and aiding in the petty ambitions of barons and kings.
You laid your trust in magic and mummery, answered Escalante carelessly. I trust my wits and my sword.
Wits and swords are as straws against the wisdom of the darkness, growled the Stygian, his dark eyes flickering with menacing lights and shadows. Had I not lost the ring, our positions might be reversed.
Nevertheless, answered the outlaw impatiently, you wear the stripes of my whip on your back, and are likely to continue to wear them.
Be not so sure!
The fiendish hatred of the Stygian glittered for an instant, redly in his eyes.
Some day, somehow, I will find the ring again, and when I do, by the serpent fangs of Set, you shall pay!
The hot-tempered Aquilonian started up and struck him heavily across the mouth. Thoth reeled back, blood starting from his lips.
You grow overbold, dog, growled the outlaw. Have a care. I am still your master who knows your dark secret. Go upon the housetops and shout that Ascalante is in the city, plotting against the king, if you dare.
I dare not, muttered the Stygian, wiping the blood from his lips.
No, you do not dare.
Ascalante grinned bleakly.
For if I die by your stealth or treachery, a hermit priest in the southern desert will know of it, and will break the seal of a manuscript I left in his hands. And having read, a word will be whispered in Stygia, and a wind will creep up from the south by midnight. And where will you hide your head, Thothamon?
The slave shuddered, and his dusky face went ashen.
Enough! Ascalante changed his tone peremptorily. I have work for you. I do not trust Dion. I bade him ride to his country estate and remain there until the work tonight is done.
The fat fool could never conceal his nervousness before the king today. Ride after him, and if you do not overtake him on the road, proceed to his estate and remain with him until we send for him. Don't let him out of your sight. He is mazed with fear and might bolt, might even rush to Conan in a panic and reveal the whole plot, hoping thus to save his own hide. Go. The slave bowed, hiding the hate in his eyes, and did as he was bidden. Ascalante turned again to his wine. Over the jeweled spires was rising a dawn, crimson as blood. 2. When I was a fighting man, the kettle drums they beat. The people scattered gold dust before my horse's feet. But now I am a great king. The people hound my track, with poison in my wine cup and daggers at my back. The Road of Kings. The room was large and ornate, with rich tapestries on the polished paneled walls, deep rugs on the ivory floor, and with a lofty ceiling adorned with intricate carvings and silver scrollwork. Behind an ivory, gold-inlaid writing table sat a man whose broad shoulders and sun-brown skin seemed out of place among those luxuriant surroundings. He seemed more a part of the sun and winds and high places of the outlands. His slightest movement spoke of steel spring muscles knit to a keen brain with the coordination of a born fighting man. There was nothing deliberate or measured about his actions. Either he was perfectly at rest, still as a bronze statue, or else he was in motion, not with the jerky quickness of overtense nerves, but with a cat-like speed that blurred the sight which tried to follow him. His garments were of rich fabric, but simply made. He wore no ring or ornaments, and his square-cut black mane was confined merely by a cloth of silver band about his head. Now he laid down the golden stylus with which he had been laboriously scrawling on waxed papyrus, rested his chin on his fist, and fixed his smoldering blue eyes enviously on the man who stood before him. This person was occupied in his own affairs at the moment, for he was taking up the laces of his gold-chased armor and abstractedly whistling, a rather unconventional performance, considering that he was in the presence of a king.
"Prospero," said the man at the table, "these matters of statecraft weary me as all the fighting I have done never did."
"All part of the game, Conan," answered the dark-haired Portanian. "You are king. You must play the part."
"I wish I might ride with you to Numidia," said Conan enviously. "It seems ages since I had a horse between my knees. But Publius says that affairs in the city require my presence. Curse him. When I overthrew the old dynasty," he continued, speaking with the easy familiarity which existed only between the Portanian and himself, "it was easy enough, though it seemed bitter hard at the time. Looking back now over the wild path I followed, all those days of toil, intrigue, slaughter, and tribulation seem like a dream. I did not dream far enough, Prospero. When King Numidides lay dead at my feet, and I tore the crown from his gory head and set it on my own, I had reached the ultimate border of my dreams. I had prepared myself to take the crown, not to hold it. In the old free days, all I wanted was a sharp sword and a straight path to my enemies. Now, no paths are straight, and my sword is useless. When I overthrew Numidides, then I was the liberator. Now they spit at my shadow. They have put a statue of that swine in the temple of Mitra, and people go and wail before it, hailing it as the holy effigy of a saintly monarch who was done to death by a red-handed barbarian. When I led her armies to victory as a mercenary, Aquilonia overlooked the fact that I was a foreigner. But now she cannot forgive me. Now, in Mitra's temple, there come to burn incense to Numidides' memory men whom his hangman maimed and blinded.
men whose sons died in his dungeons, whose wives and daughters were dragged into his seraglio. The fickle fools.
Rinaldo is largely responsible, answered Prospero, drawing up his sword belt another notch. He sings songs that make men mad. Hang him in his jester's garb to the highest tower in the city. Let him make rhymes for the vultures.
Conan shook his lion head. No, Prospero. He is beyond my reach. A great poet is greater than any king. His songs are mightier than my scepter, for he has near ripped the heart from my breast when he chose to sing for me. I shall die and be forgotten, but Rinaldo's songs will live forever. No, Prospero, the king continued, a somber look of doubt shadowing his eyes. There is something hidden, some undercurrent of which we are not aware. I sense it as in my youth I sense the tiger hidden in the tall grass. There is a nameless unrest throughout the kingdom. I am like a hunter who crouches by his small fire amid the forest and hears stealthy feet padding in the darkness, and almost sees the glimmer of burning eyes. If I could but come to grips with something tangible that I could cleave with my sword! I tell you, it's not by chance that the Picts have of late so fiercely assailed the frontiers, so that the Bossonians have called for aid to beat them back. I should have ridden with the troops.
Publius feared a plot to trap and slay you beyond the frontier, replied Prospero, soothing his silken surcoat over his shining mail, and admiring his tall, lithe figure in a silver mirror. That's why he urged you to remain in the city. These doubts are born of your barbarian instincts. Let the people snarl. The mercenaries are ours, and the black dragons, and every rogue in Poitain swears by you. Your only danger is assassination, and that's impossible with men of the imperial troops guarding you day and night. What are you working at there?
A map, Conan answered with pride. The maps of the court show well the countries of south, east, and west, but in the north they are vague and faulty. I am adding the northern lands myself. Here is Samaria, where I was born, and
Asgard and Vanaheim. Prospero scanned the map. By Mitra, I had almost believed those countries to have been fabulous.
Conan grinned savagely, involuntarily touching the scars on his dark face. You had known otherwise had you spent your youth on the northern frontiers of Samaria. Asgard lies to the north, and Vanaheim to the northwest of Samaria, and there is continual war along the borders.
What manner of men are these northern folk? Asked Prospero.
Tall and fair and blue-eyed. Their god is Ymir, the frost giant, and each tribe has its own king. They are wayward and fierce. They fight all day and drink ale and roar their wild songs all night.
Then I think you are like them, laughed Prospero. You laugh greatly, drink deep, and bellow good songs. Though I never saw another Cimmerian who drank aught but water, or who ever laughed, or ever sang save to chant dismal dirges.
Perhaps it's the land they live in, answered the king. A gloomier land never was, all of hills, darkly wooded, under skies nearly always gray, with winds moaning drearily down the valleys.
Little wonder men grow moody there, quoth Prospero with a shrug of his shoulders, thinking of the smiling, sun-washed plains and blue, lazy rivers of Poitain, Aquilonia's southernmost province.
They have no hope here or hereafter, answered Conan. Their gods are Crom and his dark race, who rule over a sunless place of everlasting mist, which is the world of the dead. Mitra, the ways of the Aesir were more to my liking.
Well, grinned Prospero, the dark hills of Samaria are far behind you, and now I go. I'll quaff a goblet of white Numidian wine for you at Numa's court.
Good, grunted the king.
but kiss Newman's dancing girls for yourself only, lest you involve the states."
His gusty laughter followed Prospero out of the chamber. 3. Under the cavern pyramids, great Set coils asleep. Among the shadows of the tombs, his dusky people creep. I speak the word from the hidden gulfs that never knew the sun. Send me a servant for my hate, O scaled and shining one. The sun was setting, etching the green and hazy blue of the forest in brief gold. The waning beams glinted on the thick golden chain, which Dion of Attalus twisted continually in his pudgy hand as he sat in the flaming riot of blossoms and flower trees, which was his garden. He shifted his fat body on his marble seat and glanced furtively around, as if in quest of a lurking enemy. He sat within a circular grove of slender trees, whose interlapping branches cast a thick shade over him. Near at hand, a fountain tinkled silverly, and other unseen fountains in various parts of the great garden whispered an everlasting symphony. Dion was alone, except for the great dusky figure which lounged on a marble bench close at hand, watching the baron with deep, somber eyes. Dion gave little thought to Thothamon. He vaguely knew that he was a slave in whom Ascalante reposed much trust, but, like so many rich men, Dion paid scant heed to men below his own station in life.
"You need not be so nervous," said Thoth. "The plot cannot fail."
"Ascalante can make mistakes as well as another,"
snapped Dion, sweating at the mere thought of failure.
"Not he," grinned the Stygian savagely. "Else I had not been his slave, but his master."
"What talk is this?"
peevishly returned Dion, with only half a mind on the conversation. Thothamon's eyes narrowed. For all his iron self-control, he was near bursting with long pent-up shame, hate, and rage, ready to take any sort of a desperate chance. What he did not reckon on was the fact that Dion saw him not as a human being with a brain and a wit, but simply a slave, and as such, a creature beneath notice.
"Listen to me," said Thoth. "You will be king, but you little know the mind of Ascalante. You cannot trust him once Conan is slain. I can help you. If you will protect me when you come to power, I will aid you. Listen, my lord. I was a great sorcerer in the south. Men spoke of Thothamon as they spoke of Ramon. King Tesphon of Stygia gave me great honor, casting down the magicians from the high places to exalt me above them. They hated me, but they feared me, for I controlled beings from outside which came at my call and did my bidding. By Set, mine enemy knew not the hour when he might awake at midnight to feel the taloned fingers of a nameless horror at his throat. I did dark and terrible magic with the serpent ring of Set, which I found in a nighted tomb a league beneath the earth, forgotten before the first man crawled out of the slimy sea. But a thief stole the ring, and my power was broken. The magicians rose up to slay me, and I fled. Disguised as a camel driver, I was traveling in a caravan in the land of Koth when Ascalante's reavers fell upon us. All in the caravan were slain except myself. I saved my life by revealing my identity to Ascalante and swearing to serve him. Bitter has been that bondage. To hold me fast, he wrote of me in a manuscript and sealed it, and gave it into hands of a hermit who dwells on the southern borders of Koth. I dare not strike a dagger into him while he sleeps, or betray him to his enemies, for then the hermit would open the manuscript and read. Thus Ascalante instructed him, and he would speak a word in Stygia. Again Thoth shuddered, and an ashen hue tinged his dusky skin. Men knew me not in Aquilonia, he said. But should my enemies in Stygia learn my whereabouts, not the width of half a world between us would suffice to save me from such a doom as would blast the soul of a bronze statue. Only a king with castles and hosts of swordsmen could protect me. So, I have told you my secret, and urge that you make a pact with me. I can aid you with my wisdom, and you can protect me. And some day, I will find the ring.
Ring? Ring?
Thoth had underestimated the man's utter egoism. Dion had not even been listening to the slave's words, so completely engrossed was he in his own thoughts. But the final words stirred a ripple in his self-centeredness.
Ring? He repeated. That makes me remember. My ring of good fortune. I had it from a Shemitish thief who swore he stole it from a wizard far to the south, and that it would bring me luck. I paid him enough, Mitra knows. By the gods, I need all the luck I can have, what with Volmana and Ascalante dragging me into their bloody plots. I'll see to the ring.
Thoth sprang up, blood mounting darkly to his face, while his eyes flamed with the stunned fury of a man who suddenly realizes the full depths of a fool's swinish stupidity. Dion never heeded him. Lifting a secret lid in the marble seat, he fumbled for a moment among a heap of gewgaws of various kinds. Barbaric charms, bits of bones, pieces of tawdry jewelry. Luck pieces and conjures, which the man's superstitious nature had prompted him to collect.
Ah, here it is!
He triumphantly lifted a ring of curious make. It was of a metal like copper, and was made in the form of a scaled serpent, coiled in three loops, with its tail in its mouth. Its eyes were yellow gems, which glittered balefully. Thoth Amon cried out as if he had been struck, and Dion wheeled and gaped, his face suddenly bloodless. The slave's eyes were blazing, his mouth wide, his huge dusky hands outstretched like talons.
The ring! By Set, the ring!
He shrieked.
My ring! Stolen from me!
Steel glittered in the Stygian's hand, and with a heave of his great dusky shoulders he drove the dagger into the Baron's fat body. Dion's high, thin squeal broke in a strangled gurgle, and his whole flabby frame collapsed like melted butter. A fool to the end, he died in mad terror, not knowing why. Flinging aside the crumpled corpse, already forgetful of it, Thoth grasped the ring in both hands, his dark eyes blazing with a fearful avidness.
My ring, he whispered in terrible exultation. My power!
How long he crouched over the baleful thing, motionless as a statue, drinking the evil aura of it into his dark soul, not even the Stygian knew. When he shook himself from his reverie and drew back his mind from the nighted abysses where it had been questing, the moon was rising, casting long shadows across the smooth marble back of the garden seat, at the foot of which sprawled the darker shadow which had been the Lord of Attalus.
No more, Ascalante. No more, whispered the Stygian,
and his eyes burned red as a vampire's in the gloom. Stooping, he cupped a handful of congealing blood from the sluggish pool in which his victim sprawled, and rubbed it in the copper serpent's eyes until the yellow sparks were covered by a crimson mask.
Blind your eyes, mystic serpent, he chanted in a blood-freezing whisper. Blind your eyes to the moonlight, and open them on darker gulfs. What do you see, O serpent of Set? Whom do you call from the gulfs of the night? Whose shadow falls on the waning light? Call him to me, O serpent of Set.
stroking the scales with a peculiar circular motion of his fingers, a motion which always carried the fingers back to their starting place. His voice sank still lower as he whispered dark names and grisly incantations, forgotten the world over, save in the grim hinterlands of dark Stygia, where monstrous shapes move in the dusk of the tombs. There was a movement in the air about him, such a swirl as is made in water when some creature rises to the surface. A nameless, freezing wind blew on him briefly, as if from an open door. Thoth felt a presence at his back, but he did not look about. He kept his eyes fixed on the moonlit space of marble on which a tenuous shadow hovered. As he continued his whispered incantations, this shadow grew in size and clarity, until it stood out distinct and horrific. Its outline was not unlike that of a giant baboon, but no such baboon ever walked the earth, not even in Stygia. Still Thoth did not look, but drawing from his girdle a sandal of his master, always carried in the dim hope that he might be able to put it to such use, he cast it behind him.
"Know it well, slave of the ring," he exclaimed. "Find him who wore it, and destroy him. Look into his eyes and blast his soul before you tear out his throat. Kill him! Aye!" in a blind burst of passion. "And all with him!"
Etched on the moonlit wall, Thoth saw the horror lower its misshapen head and take the scent like some hideous hound. Then the grisly head was thrown back, and the thing wheeled and was gone like a wind through the trees. The Stygian flung up his arms in maddened exultation, and his teeth and eyes gleamed in the moonlight. A soldier on guard without the walls yelled in startled horror as a great loping black shadow with flaming eyes cleared the wall and swept by him with a swirling rush of wind. But it was gone so swiftly that the bewildered warrior was left wondering whether it had been a dream or a hallucination. 4. When the world was young and men were weak and the fiends of the night walked free, I strove with Set by fire and steel and the juice of the Upas tree. Now that I sleep in the mount's black heart and the ages take their toll, forget ye him who fought with the snake to save the human soul?
Alone in the great sleeping chamber with its high golden dome, King Conan slumbered and dreamed. Through swirling gray mists he heard a curious call, faint and far, and though he did not understand it, it seemed not within his power to ignore it. Sword in hand, he went through the gray mist, as a man might walk through clouds, and the voice grew more distinct as he proceeded, until he understood the word it spoke. It was his own name that was being called across the gulfs of space or time. Now the mists grew lighter, and he saw that he was in a great dark corridor that seemed to be cut in solid black stone. It was unlighted, but by some magic he could see plainly. The floor, ceiling, and walls were highly polished and gleamed dully, and they were carved with the figures